All right. Tony Buckley is an Australian film editor and producer. We're here to talk to him today about film history, the film industry, and one of my favorite films, Wake in Fright, which was re-released almost a decade ago now and has become an Australian classic. Anthony, or Tony, also has an autobiography of his career in film titled Behind the Velvet Light Trap, which can be purchased online. So how are we today, Tony?
Very good, thank you, Jeff.
Excellent.
Exciting fit.
Perfect. So look, taking it right from the top, what I'd like to talk to you today about is this film, Wake in Fright, but you have spent your entire career in Australian film. So, for people who are unaware of your background, why don't we just start there? Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into film and where this started from?
Evidently, much to the puzzlement of my parents at the time, I must have been about 7 years old. I was asked what I wanted for Christmas, and I said a magic lantern. And they looked at me and thought, where on earth has this boy thought or seen a magic lantern? Anyway, my father procured a magic lantern and spent Christmas Eve removing the methylated spirits, lighting magic lantern into a 40-watt electric bulb. So the rest is a history from there. In primary school, I became a school projectionist and likewise inherited the same job when I went to high school. I became the school projectionist, and I took an interest from film from that time on. My father also was one of the first cinematographers of the 1930s, and I still have all his 9.5mm and 16mm film. But when it came to getting a job, I was a puzzlement to the people that sought young people leaving school out. I wasn't a woodworker, I wasn't interested in that, and I wasn't interested in plumbing. I did well in technical drawing, and they thought maybe the creative fields might be something there. We're talking of the 1950s. And somebody said, what about a film laboratory? And I said, what's a film laboratory? So I got a job in one for 2 years. Then I went to its parent company, CineSound Newsreel, or it's called the CineSound Review, the voice of Australia. I became a CineSounder. Then I went overseas in 58 to Canada, believe it or not, first to work for Crawley Films on their first Canadian filmed series called RCMP. Then I went to London and worked for Associated Rediffusion. I left CineSound in 1958 earning £14 a week. I came back 4 years later and took over the newsreel and got £40 a week.
So what happened then? You go over to the UK and how
Well,
do you end up back here?
2 years for Associated Rediffusion, cutting drama and what have you, decided to come back home. My mother had passed away whilst I was overseas, so she didn't have the experience of celebrating my subsequent success. Michael Powell, the great British filmmaker, gave me my break as a film editor, cutting drama for him on his film Age of Consent with Helen Mirren and James Mason.
These are a few. I mean, you spent your career in film. You mentioned Age of Consent. What are some of the other larger, higher grossing films that you're sort of proud of or recognized for?
Well, in editing, probably Rudolph Nureyev's Don Quixote, because it's still regarded as one of the best filmed ballets ever made. There was Age of Consent, which taught me a lot from a master. There was a film that's not heard of called Adam's Woman with Beau Bridges, made for Warner Brothers. That was made here, edited that. Then, of course, went on to Wake in Fright, which was known overseas as Outback. It was cutting Wake in Fright that I decided to become a producer. I knew I wasn't a director, but I thought maybe a producer because it was obvious that Ted Kotcheff directing Wake in Fright, although there was a platoon of producers, he really didn't have a producer to relate to. And I thought this was a very interesting observation. So I bought the rights to a book called Caddy, the story of a Sydney barmaid. And I didn't know where to start, but I paid for an option. And I raised the money eventually for doing the picture. Most people on Caddy, who was their first film, so it was the blind leading the blind to a certain extent. But, of course, Caddy became one of the most successful films that Australia has ever produced. It has a record still, Jeff, of 54 weeks on a single screen in Sydney, which was amazing for that time, mid-1970s. Then after that, went into film production full-time and miniseries, probably miniseries I'm better known for in many ways than film.
For a lot of people, you know, they hear the terms producer, director, and editor without really knowing the difference between the roles, but that seems to be typically the trifecta of the people who are recognized for making a film. Do you want to just briefly sort of explain the different roles and how you've worked through those positions, obviously not being a director?
Well, it's a good question because it's asked often, what does a producer do? I simplistically say the director casts the cast, I cast the crew. I believe in surrounding oneself with the best people in the business, not your boyfriends and girlfriends, not your lovers or your partners, but you get the best people, and then you won't make mistakes that many people do. Unfortunately, film does encourage people whose ambitions far outweigh their abilities a lot of the time. So I believe that the director needs all the support he can or she can have and get. That's the crew and also the outside eye keeping a watch on what's being filmed and what's on the screen every night at what we call rushes, or the Americans refer to them as dailies. Also, a producer, it's an interesting position to be in. Caddy was my idea. Bliss was my idea. Peter Carey's iconic novel. Other films are brought to me by the directors, and if I like them and think it's got legs, I'll take it on. But I've never done anything for the money. No. That's just an anathema to me. You've got to be able to believe in the film you're working on, whether it's a drama, a comedy, or a musical. And whether it's a B film or an A film, you can generally determine on the first night of rushes whether it's a B film. And that's probably based on the source, which is the script. I think our most successful films in the last 40 years for Australia have been based on books. And at one time in the 1970s and 80s, we were actually accused of making too many period films. So I got a bit shirty about this, and I did some homework and found that we were making more contemporary films set in the present time than we were period films. It was just that Australian audiences were flocking to the period stories because they were stories they'd grown up on or read in high school or did for the intermediate or high school certificate. One of my miniseries, The Harp in the South, Ruth Park's classic, iconic Sydney post-war story set in the slums of Surry Hills in Sydney, is still available in the shops in video or on DVD, and it was made in 1986. So that gives you an idea of the strength that our literature has given our cinema.
Right. Okay, cool. So, Tony, there's probably a few questions just off the answers that you've given me there. One of the things that I mentioned when they initially talk about the cuts of a film, which is handled by editors, is they talk about how horrible it might be in test screening, so they go back and re-edit the film, and that can drastically change it. As someone who doesn't work within film, this seems a little bit over the top to me, that just chopping and changing the scenes in a film can make such a drastic difference. Can you just explain that process and why editing is so important to, like, you know, the tone and overall feel and tempo of a film?
Well, the editor, the selection or casting of the editor is pivotal to the success of a film, in my view. If the editor doesn't get on with the director or vice versa, then you're in trouble. So the editing is paramount importance with the director and the editor. What happens, though, is studios very often intervene and interfere and say they don't like this or they don't like that, and they order to be recut. Very often, which is not publicised greatly, they bring another editor in to do it, which is the wrong thing to do. So having the editor in simpatico with the director, I think, is absolutely essential. And you will find, I think, Gillian Armstrong on all her pictures always uses Nicholas Bowman, because they've got a rapport and an understanding. And a good editor will predict what the director wants or how the director will want to see that a particular scene cut. And that builds a relationship. My relationship with Ted Kotcheff on Waking Fright was one of the most remarkable and memorable professional experiences I've ever had. I would cut the first cut of the kangaroo hunt, for example. He would say something or other, why don't we do this? So we do that, then I get an idea built on that, and we continually bounced ideas to the final day where we looked at the picture and said, there's nothing more we can do with this, that's it. And that's the film you see.
So, but what I'm asking is, how does an editor actually do this? What in terms of, you know, what are they trying to do when they cut up a film? Are they trying to set, when they talk about issues, is it more about the tempo? Is it about the visuals? Is it all of them in terms of how a film is edited and cut up to turn it into something pleasable?
Well, the formatting of editing has changed considerably. It used to be on a piece of film, celluloid, and now it's on a computer screen, which means probably you can get too many versions of the same scene. But that's the way it goes. An editor and the editing of a film is to do with the rhythms of the dialogue, cutting to the alternative angle on the syllables rather than when people stop talking. Let me give you an example. In the year that Cabaret won the Oscar for editing, I knew it was going to win. Yet the other film that was in the Oscars that year, The Godfather, the editing of that was far superior to Cabaret. Cabaret was very flashy and it's well edited, as opposed to just being cut. But the editing style that emerged from The Godfather is remarkable. And it's all to do with rhythms and the timings of changing the angle and going to the different performances that you have at your fingertips. I think personally editing is the most satisfying profession if you want to be in film or television, because you're there on the first day the film is shot, starts shooting, and you're there long after the director has left, at the end when the print comes from the laboratory, or now it comes on what they call a digital cinema package. It's all hard drive. It doesn't matter whether it's film or hard drive, it's the end result that matters.
Interesting. A little bit earlier, you had mentioned the term dailies or rushes. So these are segments after they're filmed. Are they immediately cut and sent back to the studio? Is that what they are?
No, not necessarily. The rushes, for example, we're talking on the telephone or we're in the studio. The camera will film you, and then the camera will film me. And then there may be another angle with the two of us in the same frame. The editor selects those on the rhythms and the dialogue that's on the page that the editor is looking at. That's the best way I can explain it. The rushes are what was shot the previous day. And no film is ever shot in sequence. You stay in the location that you are in for as long as it's needed for those scenes set in the script. Because if you go backwards and forwards in scene order, it would cost a fortune and take double the length of time to shoot the film. So the rushes, very often what we used to do, and I think they still do, at the end of every 2 weeks of filming, you would show some compiled scenes. They weren't fine, they're not fine-tuned, but they are 20 to 30 minutes of footage that makes sense because it's... So I think that's the best way I can describe it.
Okay. How do you think, you know, outside of everything sort of going digital these days, how do you think film and the industry itself has changed over the decades?
I think the worse in some respects. The digitization days, now people go back to their motel room or wherever, and the rushes will be just sent down the line via Vimeo or whatever. Whereas rushes used to be screened to the entire company at the end of the day, where you get a camaraderie and a feeling for government, what they're doing, what the makeup people are saying, and whether they're happy with the result. But that now has disappeared to a great extent because the director looks at the rushes alone in his hotel room. The editor looks at them at the studio or wherever the production is housed. So I think that's a sad trait that's occurred because that team working together during the day, getting the rushes whilst they have their beers at the end of the day, is, I think, vitally important to keeping the power of the film and the camaraderie of the crew together and the cast.
Okay. Australia is I assume, is a pretty unique market. Like, are Australian films typically profitable, or are they just made for the creation of organizations like the ABC to fit sort of a cultural narrative? It seems really hard for me to believe oftentimes that when films cost millions upon millions of dollars, and then you see them do a very limited run in only major cities for like a week or so, that they're able to turn a profit. What's the story behind that?
That's the point. You take a studio that produces 100 films a year to go to the cinemas. You would find of those 100 films they either produced or acquired to fill those cinema screens for 52 weeks of the year, a tentpole film comes along and, of course, saves the day. But about 14 in 100 films would break even, and about 4 of those 14 would be a box office smash. You've got to remember that in Germany and France, where they have their own language, they have their own film industries, both have to be government supported.
Right, okay. So what is the motivation then for studios if it's not entirely government subsidized and financed, and if the studio knows it's not going to be a blockbuster and they're not particularly pitching for an award?
The studio knows it's not going to be a blockbuster. Nobody knows where the hits are.
Really?
As it was said, sometime like in 1972, I can't remember the man's name now. It wasn't William Goldman because he stole the idea of the original statement was along the lines that anyone tells me where the goddamn hits are is a goddamn idiot. And that's true. If you knew where the hits were, we wouldn't be having this conversation because we'd be all very wealthy and sitting in some sort of mansion in Bellevue Hill. No one knows where the hits are, and I mean, I'm sure the people that made Cats, which has been a financial absolutely disaster.
Yes.
Nobody working on Cats would think they were doing a bad job, and it's not a bad film, but the audiences just don't want to know about it. And it's happening all over the place. Even Disney is making some turkeys, like the remake of Dumbo. You know, people just didn't relate to it. Television, I would say, I would concede that television's a little easier to predict whether a series will work or not work. And here's something that's of interest. You talk about the film Wake and Fright. 2 years ago, they remade, well, they made another version. I think they called it a re-imaging of Wake and Fright into a miniseries, and nobody watched it. It was a disaster.
That's right. I remember the advertising. I think that was content for the Stan Network or something.
People never set out to make a bad film either. I don't think so. They do. I said earlier in our conversation that people's ambitions very often outweigh their abilities.
Yes.
That happens in television too, but to a lesser extent. And if you've got a good running series and it has a few troughs, you can do something about it and make sure the next episode's better than the last one. With a film, what you get is what you can't go into the theatre and alter the film if some of it's not working.
Mm.
You've got to make those decisions on the previews that the studios have, or in the case of the independent films, where they'll sneak a print in to a show. For one occasion, and they'll put their people in the theatre. They call it wallpapering the theatre with free tickets, and they will study the people's reaction to the film, then go back to the cutting room and delete or reconfigure scenes that they think can be improved.
Okay. Look, you've taken us there, and that's really what I'd like to talk about today, so we might as well just start talking about Wake and Fright. Let's take it right from the beginning. This is based on a book. How did this book come to be optioned for film, and then how did you get involved with it?
Well, I was an editor of the studio in which the film was brought to. The book, of course, Kenneth Cook's book, was already a prize-winning piece of literature. The people making the film, NLT, Jack Neary and Bobby Lim, they knew entertainment, films and comedies, etc., but they wanted to do a prestigious piece, and Wake and Fright was thought to be the one. It was at one stage to be a pig hunt, because they thought the kangaroo hunt might not work as written, but that was quickly done away with, and the kangaroo hunt was reinstated. I find the film very interesting from working on it. It's probably some of my best work as an editor. But the film was directed by a Canadian, written by a Jamaican writer, British writer, who had never been to Australia. And Ed Kotcheff had never been to Australia. And backed by an American company called Group W Films, which was a division of Westinghouse, who I always thought just made refrigerators.
Yes.
How wrong can you be? I think it's fair to say that Wake and Fright is a bit of an anomaly coming from the group of production people that got the money together to make it.
For a lot of people who haven't seen the film, so again, this... For some background, this film, I think, originally came out in 1971, ended up lost, and then I became aware of it during its re-release in 2011 when it got a big national push and was re-released in cinema. I bought into it, went and watched it, and was blown away by it, because it's sort of, as someone not from that time period, it really showed or perceived to show what life would have been like at that time period. What do you think it is about this film that has sort of given it a place culturally in Australia?
I think it's won its place culturally in Australia by default, because it wasn't tolerated very well when it first appeared at the Embassy Theatre in Sydney in 1971. It went into competition at Cannes, which was a great help to any film. A title change didn't help its run overseas. They changed it to Outback. Nicholas Rogue's Walkabout was at the same time, and they thought one-word titles were fashionable. But Outback just didn't say anything. Wake and Fright, thankfully reinstated, does say something. It was picking up. It had a 10-week season, and it was faltering at the box office, but it started to pick up when people realised what the film was about, and it was making a statement about an aspect of Australian life which not too many Australians were happy to acknowledge. I think if you... I know somebody who lives here on the Central Coast who objects to the film even now because he said Australia's not like that. Well, it is, I'm afraid, in certain quarters. And you could go to Broken Hill on the train on Monday. I think there's a Monday train every week. And if you want to go out on a kangaroo hunt, it will be easily arranged.
Let me ask you about that for a second, because you said, you know, a lot of people object to what the film is about. What do you think the film is about?
Oh, well, I think it's a it's a slice of contemporary Australia which people feel uncomfortable about. And all the more reason to show it, to wake us up to what goes on around us that we may not necessarily approve of, and do it well. I personally think it's the best film made in Australia. I don't say the best Australian film, because it's not truly an Australian film in that situation of a foreign script, a foreign director, etc. But I think it encouraged Australian filmmakers to think more broadly. I'm thinking going a decade ahead from Wake and Fright to Ray Lawrence's Bliss, which the Sydney Morning Herald, when they reviewed the picture, the headline said, landmark Australian film. And I think it was a landmark for the same reason. Once again, also based on a superior piece of literature.
Mm. Do you, I thought it was a drama. The reviews and everything around it, and even the title of the film, suppose that it's a horror film. What's your take on that?
Scorsese thinks it's the most horrific horror film he's ever seen.
What does he say about the film? I'm unaware that he commented on it.
The billboards and on the posters. He and Rex Reed were in concert together in their praise for the film. People couldn't believe it when they saw it at Cannes. And with the re-release of the film after 13 years searching for it, it's reinforced its pedigree by a long way.
Can you just take us through very, very briefly, can you just summarize what the film is about? We're talking about it culturally and its impact, but a lot of people don't actually know what the film's about.
Well, the film's about an indentured school teacher who they have to do regional teaching in Australia as part of their degree to become a fully-fledged teacher. Gary Bond plays the school teacher, whose name in the film is John Grant. The Christmas holidays come, and he thinks he's getting a lift back to Sydney, when in actual fact he gets out of the semi-trailer getting the lift and found he's been taken to the Yabba, which in the film is called Bundan Yabba, which is Broken Hill. So he's trapped in a foreign area. He's befriended by the local constabulary, And the rest is then unfolds into what people describe as a horror story. And I suppose, on reflection, it is a horror film without the blood and the guts.
Mm. With the actors in that time period, you mentioned Gary Bond as the lead. It's also got Donald Pleasance, who I primarily recognize from the Halloween series of films. And it's also got Chips Rafferty, who, again, is before my time, but is considered sort of a legend of Australian film. Was this...
You see, Chips Rafferty was pre-Paul Hogan as Crocodile Dundee, but Chips Rafferty was an iconic Aussie. Mm. He played a true Australian without being a caricature.
And he plays the cop or the ranger in town in this one. Well, what was the cast that was assembled? Was it considered on the higher end? Was it just a normal film? I guess what was the grouping of these actors at this period in time for this?
With Donald Pleasance and Chips Rafferty in a film, it was pretty high end. And Peter Whittle and Jack Thompson's casting, I thought, with the time was spot on. I don't think there's one piece of bad casting in it. I'm just trying to put the images up in my brain, what's left of it now. But I tell you what fascinates me, Jess, is the language of the film. It was made in 1971. There are no F words in the film at all. The only expletive is a line that comes from a truckie that says, "You're mad, you bugger."
Yes.
And, of course, now we have four-letter words every second sentence, and I think the audiences are showing that they're getting fed up with it.
Let's also talk about, scouting the scene and being an editor on set, that's interesting to me that you were there all the time. But
I wasn't.
Oh, you weren't? Okay.
I think this is a very good thing. An editor shouldn't be on the set because it can affect you in many ways how you're thinking when you see what's going on. I was stuck in Sydney where I would talk to Ted on the phone to say everything's okay, the film looks terrific. And another thing about it where I learned to be a producer, I cut the film on black and white footage. We only got colour film every now and again when the producer would allow it. Yeah. Because it was too expensive. Now, this was a red rag to a bull for Ted and me, because we never really saw the film finished properly until the neg cutters cut the negative to match the edited footage. We saw a colour print and we got the shock of our lives.
Shocking in what way?
Fortunately, it didn't affect the tempo of the film, but we got a shock because we hadn't seen it in colour. It was a black and white film, which we knew was going to be finished in colour. I mean, every film I'd cut it up until that time, including Age of Consent and Adam's Woman and other Australian films, we always had a colour work print. But the producer on the main producer, George Willoughby, he was so mean that the cameraman, Brian West, could only get 200 feet of colour footage every week or so. And that was unfair on the team making the film, as well as unfair on the editing of the film.
We talk about the filming in Broken Hill. Again, that there are going to be people listening to this who have never set foot in Australia that are based overseas. I understand what you're talking about, but can you just talk about the big difference between Australia and our metropolitan coastal cities versus going into, you know, country and the outback and how chalk and cheese the differences are between them?
Well, I don't want to...
offender.
I don't want to give a wrong impression. But America, for example, has Wild West towns. Some of them are still wild and some of them are quite civilized. I would say that Broken Hill is a relatively civilized Wild West town. And regional Australia, the only analogy I can try and give you is that New York is not America. New York is New York. Sydney and Melbourne is not regional Australia. There's 14 million people out there who are quite different to the people in Sydney and Melbourne. And I think that's why Wake and Fright works for me, and culturally. I don't know whether you watch the ABC's delightful program called Backroads. No. They go into a regional town every week, and some of the stories they get are terrific, and it's genuine Australiana. And I think that's what's good about Wake and Fright, even though some people think it's horrific. It's Australiana, and it's a slice of it.
In your book, there's a portion of it where you mentioned that with the Canadian director on board, that you thought that was a very good choice, and the similarities and contrast between Canada and Australia, and in particular, you know, I'm Canadian. Before I came over here, I was from the prairies in Calgary, and you talk about how this was beneficial to the film and also the relationship between the two nations. Do you want to just summarize and discuss that?
Well, I think it's very simple. I know I sound a bit simplistic, but here it's hot, there it's cold. And it's the same life problems that people face in a drought, as you're experiencing here now, and sometimes in Canada when they've been frozen in for weeks at a time, even in a city like Ottawa, where the trams and streetcars couldn't move. As I say, there it's cold, here it's hot, and our lifestyles are not very different.
Going back to the film upon its initial release, it got the opportunity to be submitted for Cannes, but what was the impression of the film when it first came out? Was it well received? Was it dismissed? Did it make a lot of money?
I've never heard of a film making a lot of money. It was dismissed to a great extent as, oh, it's not like that really. That's, you know, it's not true. That was the initial reaction. The British press didn't much like it either. Dillis Powell, I can remember, was quite hostile to it and couldn't figure out how the film was allowed to be made. That was a corker. It did slow progress at the theatre in Sydney, and it only came off because of another picture, which only ran 2 weeks, it was booked in under contract. I don't think Wake and Fright played the suburbs to any extent. It was a suitable for adults only censorship. It was long before the R certificate came in. Someone, when they announced they were remaking it as a miniseries, I thought to myself, why do you remake something that's culturally significant as Wake and Fright is? I mean, my simplistic retort is, would you remake Casablanca? Mm. And the answer is no.
Fair enough. You've already talked about this so far, but again, for people that aren't aware, one of the particular scenes in this film is where they go on a cull. They hop onto some trucks. They're drinking and out there shooting roos out in the middle of nowhere. You mentioned this scene as being quite significant. Was there a particular uproar around it, or why do you think this particular scene has been so well remembered?
Although there's a degree of ambiguity at the end of the film when they say on the end credit that there was no kangaroos harmed in the making of this film.
Yes.
Well, I know what they meant to say, but it's true. The staged scenes with the kangaroos were staged. What you see in the film is what's been intercut. It's taken 2 months before the film went into production. John McClane, the camera operator and also a brilliant cinematographer in his own right, he did newsreel-type shooting of 2, 3, 4 kangaroo hunts that they actually went out on, and I intercut that footage with the staged footage.
Mm.
The statement at the end of the film, as I say, is ambiguous, but it does reflect that the rehearsed and stunt kangaroo were not harmed. But yes, what you see killed was actual footage.
There's also another scene, and again, I would have never picked this up, but it's from your book, where towards the end, to the characters, Gary and Donald, the real names are in there, there's a swinging light bulb, and you say in your book it implies some level of homoeroticism, and I've never read the book, but is that, I don't know if you're sort of saying that in jest, or if that was, I guess, implying through the film the level of depravity that they sort of get to through drink, or, I don't know, what's your take on that?
Well, what I was trying to say in the book was that it wasn't my idea. Evan Jones wrote the swinging light bulb into the script. It's there on the page. And I thought, oh, that's a good idea. And it worked. It works very well indeed.
But it's intended to imply that they end up in a sexual sexual relationship.
So, and also, if I remember rightly, there's a shot of Gary Bond's naked chest.
I have to go back and watch it. You also mentioned he later died of AIDS. Was he part of the, I guess, the gay scene at the time as well?
I don't think there was a gay scene at the time in Broken Hill.
Not in Broken Hill, but...
Or anywhere
but else. You had talked that he went on to Broadway.
He was a part of the gay scene in London much later. He was... he made his name in Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat in the West End.
What's interesting to me is when you talked about getting this film and having to cut it up, you talk about getting editor's block, which is not something, it's not a term that I've heard of before. What are the issues that you have to face when trying to cut a film?
Well, editor's block is no different to writer's block. Yeah, I'm sure... as a writer yourself and an interviewer, there are some mornings where you just look at the keyboard of the typewriter or the computer and you can't type a thing. Mm. And then suddenly you wake up and you then write 10 pages all at once. It's the same with the reel of film. I used to go into the cutting room, I'd wrestle with a scene and I'd be cranky and think it's not working, so go home. And then suddenly, when you're at home, you think, oh, I know what's wrong with that scene. So you go in at 5 a.m. and you start work, and by 8 a.m. you finish the whole reel.
We'll move on to this. So as I mentioned, this film was re-released in 2011. I remember when they were marketing it, they said, the long-lost film, it's been found. It effectively disappeared off the face of the planet, and you... became the person who went out on the fact-finding detective mission. Prior to its release, between its release in 1971 until it came back in 2011, it was considered lost. Do you think that the film was also forgotten about during that time period?
Forgotten about. Well, I think most films are forgotten about unless you're reminded of them on television or whatever. Mm. It did play television, much to my surprise, in Bill Collins' Golden Years of Hollywood. I don't think the Golden Years of Hollywood would have approved, but however, what was the question again?
Do you consider the film forgotten
culturally
during that during that time period?
In 1996, Bobby Liv and Jack Neary took me to lunch in Darling Harbour and said, where could we find the negative of Waking Friday? I said, oh, it would be at one of the laboratories in London. So I got in touch with all the labs in London, and no, it couldn't be found. Then I found it was in a bulk storage facility at Heathrow. So I got in touch with the bulk storage manager, and he said, oh, it's just gone to Pittsburgh. I said, what do you mean it's just gone to Pittsburgh? He said, well, whoever has the film have storing it in the vaults in Pittsburgh. Now, it turns out that Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has a mountain there that keeps regular temperature. And all of Hollywood's masters and negatives are kept in the mountain vaults. So we started then, pardon me, CBS, Columbia Broadcasting Systems of America, inherited Westinghouse and all their properties. Now, I'm quite sure a film called Outback, Wake and Fright, was of no interest to them. So it was earmarked for destruction because the vaults were full. We found up there in Pittsburgh some 16mm prints, but I was insistent on trying to find the negative and all the materials that go with the film, the soundtracks, the mixing tracks, all of that. Thanks to a man called Harvey Rappaport at CBS, he got so fed up with me, he went up to Pittsburgh and he got in touch with me straight away. He said, yes, I found it, it's here. He said, it's in a dump bin. I said, what's a dump bin? He said, it's got to go to the tip. And he said, I've stopped it going to the tip. You've got a week to get it out of the vaults. So thanks to Qantas, Meg Labram in Canberra at the National Film and Sound Archive, the lady in Los Angeles at the Australian Film Office, they all got together and within 10 days had all the 270 cans of film came to Australia and arrived in Canberra. It took from 2004, that was, I think, to 2009 to get the film restored. And it was done by a young man by the name of Anthos Simon at what was Atlab Deluxe Laboratories. And that's why it looks so good. In fact, we realized, having it digitally restored, that it was a revelation that the negative contained imagery that we'd never seen in the commercial prints shown in the theatres. So what you're seeing now, generally, hopefully, on a big screen or on a Blu-ray, is impeccable and better looking than it ever looked in 1971.
What is the process for restoration? Because you frequently hear about older films coming out, re-restored again and all these terms. What are they doing to it to bring it up to date?
Well, I'm not a technical person to answer that question, except to simplistically say, if it's 4K, it's going to be pretty good. It's going to mean that they've gone to the negative of the film, not just a print, and they've worked on the negative computer-wise and have delivered you a 4K master. And if you get a Blu-ray of Wake and Fright, you'll see what I'm talking about. It's better than the 35mm print.
That's pretty much all I wanted to ask you today, Tony. But for people that might be hearing about Wake and Fright for the first time, are there...
It's available on DVD and Blu-ray through Madman in Melbourne. Madman and Paul Weegard, the head of Madman, have been a staunch supporter of getting Wake and Fright out. I think something like 20,000 DVDs were initially sold in 2011.
Okay. What other films, what are some of your favorite films based around Australiana or Australian films that you would recommend for other people to check out?
Oh, well, I think any of the Peter Weir films, Picnic at Hanging Rock comes to mind, and also his horror film, The Cars That Ate Paris, that'll tickle your interest. Any of Bruce Beresford's films, Donald Crombie's superb The Irishman, not the new one, the old one. I think there's a whole collection of Australian films worth investigating and seeing where a DVD is available. And certainly new films like Last Cab to Darwin would be one of my favourites. That's Australian culture. Well, I won't go into discussing that film because I had nothing to do with it. That would be a bit rude. But I think it's good. Then you've got a very quirky Australian film by the name of Sunstruck, a British film made here, just as Wake and Fright was made here, which I call the comedy version of Wake and Fright because it's about a school teacher with an unruly class in regional Australia.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for your time today, Tony.
All right. It's been good to talk with you.
You too.